Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your first time listening or you just recently started putting us in your ears, thanks so much for choosing us. You can send us messages on social at IT Women's Podcast. Or if you like old school messages, you can email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Let us know what you think of this episode or about anything you'd like us to cover in the future. We really love hearing from you. Now this week, and by the way, Happy New Year, I hope it's starting well for you, we're going to bring you a selection of your favourite episodes from 2023. These are the ones that you listened to the most. We're going to bring you some highlights from those favourite episodes. You're going to hear Marion Keyes sharing some learnings on life as she celebrated her 60th birthday, author and academic Katrina O'Sullivan on how a chance encounter transformed her life. Also, columnist Catelyn Moran on the worrying rise of Andrew Tate and her efforts to help young men and boys navigate the world. There's also a snippet from our interview with Sinead O'Connor recorded during the promotion of her memoir, Rememberings, and a lesson on Botox from journalist and broadcaster Sally Hughes. So let's begin with the late, great Sinead O'Connor, who very sadly died last year. And you'll remember, I'm sure, that we were lucky enough to go out to her house in deepest Wicklow. We spent a lovely couple of hours with her, and it really was an amazing conversation. We're just going to bring you a few minutes of it here, but you can go back, of course, and listen to the full episode if you want to. In this particular section, we were talking about the Dublin of the 1980s and Sinead's shoplifting career, and she goes on to tell a really funny story about some shoes that she shoplifted, a story that resonated throughout her life. So here she is.
The country was broke. That's why everybody was leaving. But the reason that I was the thief too was myself and my best mate at the time, a girl called Ciara O'Flanagan, who then became my personal assistant during the glory years, as I call them. We could run 100 metres in 11.3 seconds. My father used to be a sprinter. We were fucking killer sprinters. So, but Ciara would have been too nervous to steal. But the kids in the class, the teenagers, get me to steal the clothes to go to gigs because I would just put them on the shop and run, you know, or put the shoes on and run or whatever, you know. So, yeah, it was partly that. It was like nobody had any money to go to gigs or wear something nice or, you know, get off with the guy, you know.
Yeah. And you were just I suppose you ended up in that place in High Park because of all of that, because yeah. your father didn't know how to control you and didn't know what to do with you, essentially.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is, you know, what happened was finally my mate Fiona Smith, she won't mind me naming her because she's a brat like me, you know, she asked me to steal her a pair of gold shoes because we were all going to the Pretenders. And Chrissy Hynde, to me, was an amazing figure because up until Chrissy Hynde in Ireland, the only role models you had as the type of woman you could be was images of the Virgin Mary, the Immaculate Conception, do you know what I mean? Cindy, the doll, which is the equivalent of Barbie, do you know? Cindy with the different outfits. But there was nothing I could identify with. And suddenly fucking Joan Jett and then Chrissy Hynde come along in the leather, you know, not trying, just being a person, do you know what I mean? Just the leather gear and the way she, her whole attitude, you know, changed my fucking life, actually. So anyway, Fiona wants the shoes to go to the Pretenders, and I'll tell you that this story is going to blow your mind, right, what I'm about to tell you. I steal the gold shoes out of the British Home Stores.
Do you remember BHS?
Yeah.
Was it on O'Connell Street there, was it?
It was. Yeah. And then when you turned left down the little road, there was then a little alleyway. Do you remember?
Yeah, it's still there. It's like the alleyway behind GPO, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Well, wherever that is, what happened
GPO
was
Arcade.
This time I didn't run. I got too cocky. So I walked away with the shoes. Yeah. And in the midst of that lane, I felt a hand on my shoulder. Excuse me, miss, you know. That hand on my shoulder was the beginning of my career because it sent me to on Greenon, right? And wait till I said, this is the part that's going to blow your mind. Years later, I think nothing of it, and I've met Chrissy a few times, and that's grand. And what happens is Paul McCartney's wife dies, and Paul puts on a gig at the Royal Albert Hall in honour of Linda, the wife.
Yeah.
And we're all, like, I've got, you know, we're all real posh dressed up, and I ordered a beautiful dress months before, a red strapless dress. I forgot my shoes. And I never thought about this until about 2 years later. I used to put shoes on the mantelpiece, like works of art. They look beautiful sometimes, you know.
Mm.
Anyway, I never thought a thing about it. She lent me her shoes for the gig, right?
Chrissy Hynde.
Chrissy Hynde gives me the shoes. And then at the end of the gig, she says, oh, you can keep them. So I bring them home. I'm in the apartment in Bride Street. By the time I noticed this, it's a couple of years after I left London. And I had them in my windowsill just because they're pretty. And then I'm looking at them and going, holy shit.
Oh, my God.
I got locked up over stealing a pair of gold shoes to go see that fucker. And now she's given me the gold. It's like, it was like God saying, sorry. And actually, do you know what, Sinead? It was all for a good purpose,
that's,
do you
mad.
Know? Isn't it mental?
And I love that image of that hand on your shoulder starting
that was the start
everything.
Of the career, yeah. Totally.
And off you went to Hyde Park.
Yeah, not straight away that day. What happened was,
but
the cops got, you know, Tusla involved, and a social worker was employed. A horrible woman, fucking hated her, and she recommended to my father and my stepmother that I should go to this place. And my father, my stepmother, who's adorable, trusted these people, you know, with the best of intention. They believed that it was called a rehabilitation centre for girls with behavioural problems. And as I'm saying in the book, you know, my dad needs a refund. But the state paid them for us, and sometimes our parents also did. You know, the state would try to get away with it if they could. So my father, believing that the word rehabilitation sent me there. So it wasn't that he was being an asshole. In fact, he was being the opposite, you know. He really wanted me to go on the right path. He was afraid I would choose the path that my mother had set out for me and I would end up in jail, you know.
That was the incredible Sinead O'Connor there. And just to remember that that documentary that was made about her, the award-winning documentary Nothing Compares, is also available to view and stream, and I would really highly recommend it. The next clip we have to bring you is from an episode I know you all really enjoyed, and it was Marion Keyes, who turned 60 last year and came into us with some of her amazing life lessons, including how to apologise, she says, is one of the most important things we can ever learn. And there's a couple of people in my life who could do with a few lessons on that. I think it's sometimes particularly hard for men to do it, actually. But yeah, and I found in my life apologising soon and with absolute grace and without any excuses can get you through a lot of difficult patches. And Marion certainly, in her wisdom, agrees with that. And here she is talking about apologising, but also other life lessons.
The most important life skill that any of us will ever learn is the ability to apologise. You know, like, people are feckin', you know, climbing mountains and doing Duolingo and, you know, making jewellery and... But this, learning to apologise, knowing how to apologise properly, with sincerity and with no, yeah, but you shouldn't have done that, you know, just to apologise is, well, it's a very, I mean, it's difficult. But apologies are about two things for me. I mean, and I am very prone to, like, wild irritation. When I'm annoyed, which is a lot of the time, actually, that's another thing about being old, you know, I give out. I'm very vocal. And then I feel like shit, you know, because if I've hurt somebody, it's very, very difficult. You know, I feel I don't want another person to be upset because of something I've done. I don't want to make the world slightly worse than it already is. But I also apologise for myself, because carrying that shame and regret around with me, it never goes away. I tried to pretend that the event didn't happen. And I sort of think, I will never go to that place ever again. You know, maybe the entire city of Bologna. You know, I will just never, I'll never go to Italy. And, well, Europe, the continent of Europe. If I just never go there, then I won't be reminded of that terrible way I behaved. But if I pluck up, or kind of connect with the mature part of myself and try and mind the mortified child part of myself and go along and do my apologies, it means that I can visit Europe again and indeed Italy and maybe even Bologna. You know, like the apologizer gets as much, if not more, out of it than the apologize-y, if that's a word.
Yeah, I think we can make it a word.
Okay.
It's not.
Yeah. Now, can we talk about romantic relationships?
Oh, yeah.
I have such strong feelings on it. Okay. And I suppose I'm saying this for the youngs.
The youngs.
Yeah.
We have a lot of the youngs listening to the podcast.
Yeah, actually. And like I was a very, complicated young. And I thought, well, first of all, I thought there was the one. The one does not exist. You know, there is no such thing. Don't be wasting your time. You meet somebody and he's really nice or she's really nice or whatever. And then you find out they have awful taste in music or socks or whatever. You don't like burn it all down just because of that. Because we're all just flawed human beings staggering around in the fog, doing our best. And you could be the person with the bad socks or the dodgy earrings or whatever to somebody else. And you wouldn't like to be, you know, dismissed entirely because of that. We have to realise that the people we fall in love with are as incomplete as we are. You know, we can't look to other people to make us feel complete. Like we can't. It's impossible. I can't do it for anyone else and nobody else can do it for me. And you know that whole thing about bad boys, which is just so utterly tragic, you know, and I say this as like, you know, I am a card carrying, you know, award winning bad boy follower. And we should just call them what they are, which is bad men. And what I used to get from those relationships was nothing to do with what I would get from healthy relationships. And when you think about it, we wouldn't ever be platonic friends with somebody who was cruel to us, who lied to us, who cheated on us, who was dishonest, who undermined us. Like, you just wouldn't, you know? But throw sex into the mix and suddenly we're like, oh, you know, he's so, I mean, my God, it's like, you know, so passionate and, the you know, it's not passionate, it's unhealthy. And for me, what I was doing was I was so incomplete by myself that I was using kind of the adrenaline of those encounters as a substitute for actual connection. Or I was using, like, when he would finally ring, because this was a long time ago, you know, the relief that I got was like a rush of, like, some sort of, what do they call it?
Yeah, the endorphins and all.
No, there's another thing. What's heroin made of?
Oh,
yeah, one of them.
When I got in the after I had my cesarean in the hospital, they give you the bloody morphine.
It's
good stuff.
It's like a phenomenal pain reliever, and that's what it was like for me. Whereas in relationships, and again, the youngs, I suppose we all have to learn for ourselves. You need to be with somebody who's kind. You know, like there's no other feckin' point. You've got to be with somebody who's your friend, who likes you, who wants to protect you, who's on your side. And it won't be perfect. You know, they will still do things that like drive you bananas.
That was the marvellous Marion Keyes there on her life lessons at 60. And continuing on the theme of lessons, we had another great broadcaster and a beauty expert, Sally Hughes, in with us. And she was talking to us about the publication of her book, Everything is Washable and Other Life Lessons, which contains an absolute multitude. But I was particularly interested in Sally's take as a beauty journalist on Botox, because I know many of you will have used Botox. Some of you will have very serious judgments for or against it, and it can be quite controversial, but not according to Sally Hughes. And I think it would be nice to look back on what she said about the use of that cosmetic treatment.
Honestly, I just think people need to absolutely get over themselves, over Botox. I have to say, I'm very aware that I'm on the Irish Times podcast, and this is quite relevant, I think. I'm from Wales. I don't think Irish women and Welsh women have got a problem here, I have to say. By and large, when I come to Ireland, women will just talk to each other about whatever's going on, right? But in And the same is in Wales. My friends in Wales go and get their Botox and they text each other to come around and look at it, right? So this is not a problem for some parts of the world. However, I would say there is a very middle-class English problem where women treat Botox. They either look down their nose and sneer at women who get it, or they get it themselves and they lie about it. And I think neither things are helpful or friendly or kind to women. So many people get Botox now. If Botox had existed 100 years ago, men and women would be getting it then as well. If you do it safely and properly with a reputable practitioner and you really do your due diligence, why not? This idea that it's some sort of terrible failing and letting the side down is just absolutely absurd. I don't see people with highlights or teeth whitening or hair dyeing out their greys getting into trouble. But for some reason, there's this very kind of sneering weirdness about Botox. And so I thought I wanted to write about that. I've never, ever, ever denied or lied about the fact that I get Botox. And I just thought, I just want to put it in print and kind of give anybody who's worried about it printed permission to just do what they want with their own face and to tell people to get over themselves. And, you know, as I say, I come to Ireland and there's just this, you know, I come to Ireland fairly often, as you know, very often you and I might have drinks or whatever. And there's something about Irish women that is so similar to Welsh women, where there's a joy, there is an open joy in getting ready, in looking nice, in caring about your appearance, in putting on your war paint, glamming up, going out and having a good time. And that's what I'm used to where I come from. But what you see in kind of, you know, in well-heeled parts of London or whatever, is people who somehow think that that gets in the way of them appearing intelligent or cultured or engaged, or they worry it betrays them as being vain or silly or money to burn and all of that stuff. And I just think it's so silly.
Yeah. And what about the argument where people feel it's not feminist to do that? You know, you should be able to just let your skin become what it's going to be and age in the way that nature intended. What's your response to that?
Well, personally, I find that weird. I love defying nature. That's why I don't have babies when I don't want to have babies. That's why I take antibiotics when I've got some kind of bacterial infection. I defy nature all the time. Hooray for defying nature. That is what allows us to live life as we do as feminists. So this idea that you must be natural to be feminist is ridiculous. Otherwise, we'd all have 20 babies, right? So the thing about Botox being unfeminist, to me, the most unfeminist thing is telling women how to look. And if you tell women how to look or how they should live their lives, whether that is that they must be wrinkle free or they must have wrinkles, neither is helpful. I don't think a prescriptive approach to what women should do with their lives is good. The moment I hear women should, I'm out. I'm just like, oh, go away. Like, my interest is lost when I start hearing about what women should do. Do get Botox, don't get Botox. I honestly don't care. I think that people need to stop telling women what they should do or not do with their faces.
That was Sally Hughes there.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, the next highlight from 2023 on the Women's Podcast I'm going to bring you is our interview with Katrina O'Sullivan. We've had Katrina on recently in reviewing the year, but this was from her interview with me about her book Poor. She wrote an amazing memoir which won 2 awards at the Irish National Book Awards. And the clip we've chosen is her talking about this chance encounter on O'Connell Street with a woman, which ended up inspiring Katrina to go back to Trinity College. And she, in fact, went from that meeting straight over to Trinity College. And that encounter kind of changed her life and set her off in a totally different trajectory than the one she'd been on. I'm a big fan of Katrina O'Sullivan, as you know. I've gushed about her often enough on this, so we had to include her. So here she is talking about that moment that really did change her life.
So literally, like every Thursday morning, I'd be in Summerhill, I'd get my lone parent's book, head straight over to Penny's and get myself a few bits. Then I'd probably get myself a fry on Parnell Street. This is what we did. And this particular day, I remember I met Karen outside Penny's on O'Connell Street and how's going, what's the story? She was like me, she had kitsch on her own. And she was like, I'm in Trinity College. And I'm like, fuck off. Like literally, like I did not think they let you in. Like I thought that there was a beeper that would like tell if you had like, if you knew what couscous was and if you wore a satchel and a scarf, you know what I mean? And I say that facetiously, but genuinely, I thought they wouldn't let us in.
Like if you were wearing gold hoops.
Yeah, I loved my hoops, like, and my tan and my hunbun at that time. So like, I'm like, what? You know, having somebody like me in there was just pivotal. Like, and I know like I'm held up as an example for other girls, but like, it's not just that she was in there. There was all these other system things in place. But like, one thing you have to remember about girls like me, like I'm really skilled. Like I've survived, like I'm resilient, I'm mouthy. I'm able to advocate for myself, which is mouthy.
You can read a room.
I can read a room. I'm sensitive to changes. All these, I can research because I'm like spying on my mom and dad my whole life. So like, there's loads of reasons other than trying to rescue people, to empower them to participate. Like we bring skills to the world if you just give us the opportunity to flourish. And so that skill, when she told me she was in Trinity, I was like, if she's going to her, I'm going there.
So you didn't go for a fry, which is amazing. You turned around, you crossed over the bridge.
I went over to Goldsmith Hall.
Hilarious. And I mean, that to me was just a brilliant, like you actually didn't wait to go home and think about it.
No,
you
just went over.
Yeah.
And I knocked on the door. Irina Boydell, another woman who changed my life. Like these stepping stones. And I talk about it in the book. I am very small in my own story, like in my own story of success. I know people like to think that I did it. I didn't. I was helped so much along the way. Karen, Audrey Coakley was
Mr. Pickering in England. We haven't spoken to him. He was her teacher, amazing man.
Yeah, so like there were so many people who just saw potential in me and actually gave me an opportunity. Irina Boydell knocked on the door. Excuse me, I heard about this thing called the Trinity Access Programme. My friend Karen's doing it. She stood in Lorna. She was like, breathe, come in. Unfortunately now, you can't do that. So like you can't knock on the door of the Trinity Access Programme now and get to know the person. It's so much bigger now, so much harder. So that personal element isn't in it, unfortunately. But at that time, Irina, this is the really important piece, is that I told her, I don't know why, if it was the day that was in it, but I said everything. I said, I'm so lost. My mom and dad were this. I love books. I can't tell anyone that. I want a life. And she just looked at me and she was like, aren't you so amazing? And to have one of them middle-class women
with the flowers,
in a modest dress, who's in Trinity College, tell you're amazing is mind-blowing. Like I just felt a few feet taller in that moment. And she said to me, we would love you to apply. And I found myself like 3 weeks later in an interview with these lecturers. But I did my work. Like I investigated what it was. I didn't know what I was actually getting into, because I think if I'd have known what it was like to study in Trinity, I might not have applied. Mm. And I'm not trying to put other people off, but it's not like this fairy tale where you go in and you feel like you belong. Like it's tough. Not academically. Academically, I was well able, like, and I thrived. But the other bits were really hard, especially that as I was a mother on my own and I had all this stuff. But actually, I found myself in this interview thinking I was blowing it. And then he asked me about books. And again, Mr. Pickering and all of my people who'd invested in me, I was able to like just tell them then. I was reading The Road Less Traveled. I never, Anthony DeMello. I was like, well, theoretically, you know, but I was alive then and they could see it. And I knew I'd got it. And the wonderful thing about that, and it's sad for me now, but like my dad framed the letter, the offer letter. He was so, I think for him, it was like, I didn't ruin everything. I didn't ruin everything.
Yeah.
So I used to go into his house and he'd have this, dear Katrina, you know, he framed everything actually, but that for onwards around Trinity, but that was the thing that really he was so proud of. Mm. And I love that, that he got, you know, that feeling.
That was Katrina O'Sullivan, author of Poor There. And if you haven't read that book, I really do recommend you go and get it because it's eye-opening and really important as well. Our next highlight from 2023 is a woman who's been on this podcast several times in the 8 years we've been running it, I think it's now, and it's Caitlin Moran. Caitlin came out with a brilliant book last year called What About Men, which sort of tried to tackle all the sort of toxic masculinity and all the issues that young men and older men are facing. So she's kind of trying to apply what she did in terms of her feminism to men and trying to help a world where the likes of Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson are taking hold a lot in terms of their thinking in the lives of young men and to try and challenge that a bit. So I wanted to ask her about her research into Andrew Tate and how he's affecting kind of the minds and the thoughts and the hearts of young men and what she thinks we can do about it. So these were her thoughts on Andrew Tate.
Every single person I have spoken to in the educational system has gone, yeah, we've had to have staff meetings at school to deal with this. So female teachers are getting homework handed back by boys with make me a sandwich written on the bottom. Like, you should not be teaching me. Male teachers are having boys going, do you let your wife go on her own, sir? So the amount of resources that are being put into this one man. And when he was first on the rise, I had a lot of conversations with good liberal progressive feminist friends whose sons were being sort of sucked into his ideology. And they were like, we don't understand. We're good liberal progressive feminists. What was the appeal? And I was like, I think it might be because you were good liberal progressive feminists, because has your son grown up in a house where you would be saying, ah, oh, typical men, typical straight white men, toxic patriarchy, the man, you know, sort of like, you know, masculinity. And they were like, yeah. And I was like, well, yeah. That's why, like, the progressive men of my generation, when this wave of feminism came along, brilliantly and politely just went, fair enough. This is a very recent and relatively mild corrective to 10,000 years of patriarchy and Benny Hill chasing sexy schoolgirls around a tree. Well, let the ladies have a go. We'll just pipe down. But suddenly, a generation's gone past, and these teenage boys don't have that perspective. They don't see how recent it is. All they know is that they live in an era where we're constantly saying, the future is female. In every magazine and newspaper, we would have a list of 50 women who are going to change the world. You know and I know, no one would commission a list of 50 men who are going to change the world. Like, not now. That would be seen as problematic, because we're of a generation where we're like, no, we're still rebalancing the sexism and inequality.
Thousands of years,
yeah, but the boys don't have that perspective. So all they know is that there are feminist clubs at school. Like, kind of, we're just, you know, we're writing books like 100 kick-ass female heroes from history. But suddenly a generation's gone by where we just haven't had any kind of positive, progressive, uplifting conversation about boys and men. And so that's why when Andrew Tate pipes up, he's the first person in their lifetime who's gone, no, boys are great. In fact, boys should rule the world. Masculinity is great and you can't have enough of it. So, of course, coupled with a sense of teenage rebellion and wanting to, like, fuck your parents off, like, he seems like a massively appealing figure.
It's really interesting to say that, because I would probably be one of those people as well, you know, talking about women. But I have teenage daughters who thankfully don't yet listen to this podcast, so I think I can speak freely until, I don't know. Anyway, they are quite down on boys at the moment, right? They find, you know, they're in a mixed school and they find, like, the boys in their class or in their year, they're scared of them a bit. They feel like they're not people that they can relate to, and they're being very down on boys. And I find myself lately trying to go, no, they're just lovely people, and I'm sure they're just going through stuff that you're going through. And, you know, when they get a bit older, you know, girls are probably a bit more mature a bit earlier. And it's really interesting how I'm finding, I want them to go to a mixed school. I don't know if it's different, Caitlin, to England. Here, you know, mixed schools are kind of the outliers. Oh, really? Most of them are single sex, which it's a whole other podcast, but I really think it's terrible.
Yes.
But they happen to go to a mixed gender school. And it makes me so sad that their impression of boys at the moment, and I don't know if it's Andrew Tate stuff or whatever it is, or is it just like they're just a bit loud and they're a bit sensitive? I'm not sure. But it's just, I find myself having to defend these young guys who I imagine are going through all the things that you're sort of talking about.
Well, the problem is, and like kind of one of the things that I'm trying to make clear in the book is that like kind of like when you've got like, you know, let's just be very basic and generalized, that's my thing, good men and bad men. I think the majority of men are good. But like the small cohort of bad men are ruining it for not only the girls, but for the boys as well. So, for instance, my daughter was, she was in charge of the school yearbook. And she was like in charge of like, and she was like, sent out a WhatsApp message to the whole year going, has anyone got any pictures of like trips we've been on and school plays and stuff? And I put them in the yearbook. All the girls sent back pictures of trips and plays. The boys started spamming it with like really extreme porn and like kind of like, you know, Bukkake shots and kind of pictures of kids with learning disabilities, kind of like, you know, and all this stuff. And like, it was only four or five boys, but because there isn't anything like feminism for men, the good boys didn't know what to do. They didn't want to be seen to like, kind of like, you know, the party poopers or like to tell off other boys in the way that I think women are much better at policing each other. Like kind of like, had a girl been problematic on there, feminism has become good, sometimes too good at women scolding other women, but at least there is a self-regulation there. Mm. So the boys, the good boys don't know how to counteract the bad boys. So then the girls are like, oh, well, they're making all their judgments about boys just on the bad boys and the fact that the good boys are silent. And so like my daughters went through a massive man-hating phase. Like, they, you know, it's kind of like partly in that way you do when you discover your feminism and you always go a bit too far at the beginning. Like, I don't know if you've seen the film Moxie, but it's about a
group
of, oh, it's amazing. Oh, you'd love it. Okay. It's about a good group of teenage girls in a school with some bad boys and they discover feminism, but they take it too far.
Okay.
And they just become absolute misandrists and boy-hating and then they have to learn to turn it down. They get a bit drunk on the feminism.
Yeah.
So my girls were very much man-hating. And then they read my book and they were like, and they came in and they looked quite abashed and they were like, yeah, I just realised that when I go around saying I hate all men, that's actually the good boys are being sad about that, but they don't even know how to say, like, kind of that makes me sad, because they've been brought up to go, don't mansplain over a woman who says that she hates men. Mm. And my ultimate thing, like, there were quite a few feminists who were like, when I announced that I was doing this book, who were like, oh, you've abandoned the women then. Like, kind of, you're saying that men, like, you know, you're team men now. I was like, no, this is absolutely an extension of my feminism, because as any woman will tell you, 50% of our problems are men. Bad men, scared men, angry men, misogynist men. So you can't fix the girls until you fix the boys. And you can't fix the good boys until you fix the bad boys. Because ultimately, we're all just brothers and sisters, you know, in the back seat of a car, being driven by our Lord Jesus Christ to the ultimate destination of the grave. And we can't be fighting on the back seat. It's a very short journey, really. We die quite quickly. So my whole thing is about, we've just got the brothers and sisters need to get on with each other. And so if you look at what's making boys angry and scared and sad, it helps both the women and the good boys who just are sitting there without any kind of vocabulary to discuss how they feel about their lives in the way that we've given girls a vocabulary to do that, which is feminism.
And that was our final highlight in your favourite episodes of 2023 with Caitlin Moran. So I hope you enjoyed that little look back. From next week, we'll be looking forward again and going back to our regular run of shows. But if you enjoyed this episode and if you enjoy the podcast generally, please do leave us a review or subscribe to the podcast, as it really makes a difference to us. It's produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us on thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Happy New Year. I hope you have a brilliant 2024 and I hope you stay listening to us right throughout it. That's it from me. Mind yourselves and I will talk to you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.